The following episode contains mature content, including graphic descriptions of a sexual nature. Parental discretion is advised for any listeners under the age of 18.
Saturday afternoon at the edge of the world. White pages lift in the wind and fall. Dust threads cut loose from the heart float up and fall. Something's off key in my mind. Whatever it is, it bothers me all the time. It's hot and the wind blows on what I've had to say. I'm dancing a little dance. The crows pick up a thermal that angles away from the sea. I'm singing a little song. Whatever it is, it bothers me all the time. It's Saturday afternoon and the crows glide down. Black pages that lift and fall. The castor beans and the pepper plant trundle their weary heads. Something's off key. And unkind. Whatever it is, it bothers me all the time. Laguna Blues, a poem by Charles Wright.
When one has an existentialist view of the world like mine, the paradox of human life is precisely that one tries to be and, in the long run, merely exists.
Who are you?
This is an interview with Tennessee Williams. And the first question I'm going to pose to you, Mr. Williams, is the following. Why do you write?
That is an excellent question.
Give your body to it. Give your laugh to it. Give.
The Paris Review Podcast, Episode 16, Lift and Fall. The episode began with a poem by Charles Wright, read by Bill Callahan. And later, you'll hear a poem from Anne Sexton, read by Jenny Slate. Plus, archival tape from our 1981 Art of Theater interview with Tennessee Williams. And now, a short story by J.M. Holmes, read for us by the author.
What's wrong with you? What's wrong with me? Fiction by J.M. Holmes.
How many white women you been with? The room was filled with good smoke, and we drifted off behind it. What's your number? Dub looked at Rye real serious, like he was asking about his mom's health. I leaned forward from the couch and took the burning nub of joint from his outstretched hand. We called him Dub because his name was Lazarus Livingston, double L. His parents named him to be a football star. He could play once upon a time, but not like Rye. Rolls, who was too high, chimed in. Stop it, bruh. That's just not important. Of course it is. I'm finna touch every continent, Dove said. White's not a continent, Roll said. You know what I mean. I know you never wanted geography, B, Roll said. The room was streaked with haze, like we dropped cream in a coffee. But Roll's never cracked windows. He smoked like a pro even still, burned blunts and let it box out the room. He had the leather furniture from his dad's old office and we sank into it. These days, he got lit every morning before work, after his bowl of smacks. His latest was shooting an ad for the ambulance chaser, Anthony Izzo. I was about to ask him if he still painted. Why won't you answer the question? Dove said. Gio would answer. He looked at me. Wouldn't you, G? Don't play this game, I said. How many? Man, G don't count. He's mixed. That's a performance-enhancing drug. Rye tagged me light on the chest. He speaks, Dove said. Shut the fuck up, Rye said. Whoa, peace, Roll said. My place is a sanctuary. Stop it with the Buddhist bullshit, Dove said. I put the joint out. Rye started rolling another. Roll stood but put his hand on the armrest to steady himself. He straightened up. It's Brahmin, he said. Bruh, shut the fuck up, Rye said. Roll smacked his lips and looked at Rye. You two belong together, he said. I'm getting a drink. Get me one, I said. Roll wiped his eyes and left to the kitchen. Really though, why you being shy? Dub nudged Rye. Their huge frames looked goofy, sitting on the couch together. Boulders sinking into the leather, jostling each other like idiots. Nigga, stop. I'm rolling. You'll ruin the J. My God. You've never fucked a white chick. Don't be stupid. You haven't. Rye began licking the edges and shaking the cone down. Don't pack it too tight, I said. Maddie teach you that? Rye said. Rye knew I didn't roll well. But my girl rolled J's better than him and Roll's. She kept the J loose enough to pull well, but tight enough not to burn sloppy or canoe. I love watching her manicured fingers at work. During one of our college breaks, I brought her back to the city and I showed her around. She rolled our weed and talked above us, underneath us, and around us. My boys cracked jokes and looked out for her. They treated her like a long-lost porcelain-colored cousin. She said our outdoor weed was garbage. We called it middies. She called it swag. Both equated to trash. Rye said that Maddie was the first woman he ever bought a drink for. But I'd seen his lying ass spend money on chicks in high school. That's one hell of a white girl, Rye said. Don't change the subject. We talking about you, I said. How is the old lady? Dub said. You gonna let him off the hook? I said. Dub pulled on his nose the way he did when he was thinking of some heinous shit. I just want to know how the treads are, he said. Yeah, how's it hitting? Rye said. I leveled my eyes at him. That's wifey. Stop being soft, Dub said. He's team light skin, let him be, Rye said. You're a fucking macadamia nut. They were both silent for a second, then started laughing. Y'all are stupid, I said. Sing me a love song, Urkel. Dove said. Rye looked away. Rolls returned and handed me my drink. It tasted like straight coke, and I told him. Strength is life, weakness is death, he said. Man, I don't even know why I come here, Rye said. Because you're scared of your landlord. Rolls took the joint from him. Gandhi's got jokes, Rye said. Rye's landlord was a fat Irishman with an absurdly thick neck. He didn't mind Rye moving in because he remembered watching him play football when Rye took the team to a state title. Rye kept his music turned down and entered the house without switching on the stair light when he came home real late. We could never smoke at his spots, now or growing up. At his mother's house, we couldn't smoke because she'd wake up and press us for some. Rye would pretend it didn't bother him, but she'd start wringing her hands and looking off because she wanted more than trees. And I would stick my head in the fridge and pretend there was something there to look at. My boy's not scared of that fat Mick, Dove said. But he's clearly scared of white pussy. Let it rest, I said. Fear is the center of all hate, Roll said. You smoked out, Dove said. Rolls passed me the joint and got up to throw on a record. In middle school, Ryan and I used to bump Dipset, wasting our freshman highs on gangster rap with no dimension. Sped up drums, pitch altered samples, chopped up and arranged to bang like gunshots. We would smoke weed in my Aunt Mary's basement because she worked a lot and was hardly home. We sprayed air freshener and enjoyed the cool mist on our skins as we walked through and back in a daze. She never came down, but we sprayed it anyway. One day, he left upstairs to go to the bathroom and didn't come back. I waited a while, longer than that or shorter, letting the minutes bend around me and grow fat as I climbed into the high. I thought I heard a door shut. I sprayed more, thinking it was my aunt, home early for some reason. I tripped up the stairs, boots heavier than usual. No one was in the kitchen, living room. There were some orange peels, where I always ate my food. He said football players needed the calories. I wondered if he'd gone to 7-Eleven for more snacks, but his coat was still on the counter. I went by the bathroom, door open, fan still on. Computer room, empty. But the computer was loading. I sat down to see what recruiting videos he was watching. But after a minute, he hadn't returned. I went into the hall. My aunt's door was open. I went to bust in and cuss him out, but came up quiet inside my high. In the room, he moved around slow, came to her dresser and studied her pictures. He picked the one of her standing next to her flavor of the year, Luca, on a beach in Rio. She looked tan in her purple bikini. Rai stared for a while. Then he reached his hand to open the top drawer of the dresser. "What the fuck?" I said. Rai was so shook, he banged his knee on the shelf. "Shit, man. Why are you sneaking up on me? What the fuck are you doing?" "I got lost," he said. "You're not that high." He sat on the bed rubbing his knee. I gestured at the drawer. "That shit is weird," I said. He stood and set the photograph upright again. Paused. "She's sexy, man." I slapped him on the back of the head. He made like he was going to tag me on the chest. I flinched. I made like I was going to tag him. He flinched too. "She got those green eyes," he said. "Fuck's wrong with you?" He paused like the question was philosophical. "I've been conditioned," he said. Rolls cranked up the impressions. "So People Get Ready for the Train to Jordan." I love that song. But I was surprised Ryan Dub let it ride. Years ago, Dub would have cut it off and tried to convince us to hit the clubs on Westminster. But he'd wind up at a house party with Jungle Juice and dancehall playing instead. Now we got higher and thought ahead to Thanksgiving, about chopping it up with whatever family we had left. Rolls had his attempts at abstract art hung on the walls. Maybe it was the smoke, or the way the red, green, and white paint seemed to pop over the black roofing material, but the work was actually beautiful, balanced. "He won't tell us because he hasn't been with any," Dub said. "How many have you been with?" Rai said. "Too many to count," Dub smiled. "Stop lying." "I like to take him in the shower, let him bathe me," Dub said. "You watch too much porn," I said. "I even had this one," Dub said. "Cecil, after she finished washing me, she hit me with the Eddie Murphy line." "Bullshit," Rai said. "Real talk." She said, "The royal penis is clean, your highness." "You're lying," Rai said. "Now why would I lie?" Roll said, "You add to the mischief of the world." I liked to wash Maddie's hair when we were in the shower together. The way it trapped water and became heavy, satin in my hands. She thought mine was waterproof. Her shampoo smelled of sweet citrus and vanilla. She let it air dry in the kitchen while she made steel-cut oats with flax for breakfast. I drenched the hippie shit in syrup and told her how good it was. "Yeah, aight," Rai said. "I just treat them how they want to be treated. Choke the daddy issues out of them. If they want me to play Dominican, I let them call me Poppy. Anything but gentle. Long as you know that, you're straight." "La lying ass, Rye started. Don't be mad at me. You should really do better for yourselves. You play ball, Dub said. I've fucked white women, Rye said. Then tell us how many. I'm leaving if you don't stop, I said. Rye took a deep pull from his drink. It wasn't his pace. You ain't gotta be mad. We ain't talking about Maddie, Dub said. When Dub and I used to slap box in high school, Rye would always break it up before we close-fisted one another. Dub said I was too pretty to throw hands anyway. I told him his bulky ass was too slow to fade me. He'd said, light skin bruised like fruit. You think she been keeping herself pure for you? Dub said. Easy, Dub, Roll said. You think some big motherfucker ain't coming around here to hit it right while you're away? I stood up. He leaned forward. You got something else to say? I said. He brushed some ash off his long leg. You heard me. Dub, fall back, Roll said. I kept my eyes locked on Dub. You fucking hear me? I said. The music changed tracks and went on. Old Cole. Now you're shook, cuz I slapped the joint out of his mouth before he could finish. He was halfway up when Rye grabbed him in a bear hug, there on the couch. Dub threw his elbows a few times trying to break free. Calm down, Rye said. Calm down. Nah, this nigga thinks this girl ain't community property. It's a revolving door when you ain't here, Captain Save-A-Ho. You the only nigga that kissed that bitch on the mouth. I tried to get close enough to swing, but Rolls had gotten up and was standing in the way. Calm the fuck down, Rye said. Go wait outside, he said to me. Fuck that. I know niggas that pipe. I lunged and swung at Dub's face, but at the last moment, Rolls tried to step back in front and tripped on the table. My knuckles landed on the side of his jaw. I felt the connection, like when the baseball hits the sweet spot of the bat. It caves with a softness. Rolls fell against Rye, then into the couch. Blood already outlined his teeth. Rye and Dub still struggled. I didn't know whether to apologize or keep swinging. I felt like I was in a pool of water and my limbs were weak and slow. Then Rolls kicked me in the shin with his heel. Get out, he said. Get the fuck out.
The second part of What's Wrong With You, What's Wrong With Me by J.M. Holmes, read by the author, when the Parish Review podcast continues.
It was cold out, and leaves scratched down the block. Rye said that Rolls was fine. We were faded. The night was dark. We headed toward East Ave, back towards Rye's. He stumbled a little bit, leaving the glow of the orange street light and falling into the shadow for a moment. I haven't had an empanada in a while, I said. Yeah, he said. You've been gone a minute. His voice sounded far off. A car wheeled by with the windows rattling. So were you. Rye stopped, burped, and let it out into the night like dragon fire. He took a quick right into the back streets. I tripped a little trying to follow him. Forget the shortcuts. Stefano's yellow awning came up on the right, a high man's beacon to buñuelos and ramen hot enough to peel the weed film off of our tongues. That was high school. The inside smelled the same as always, grease and incense. The baked goods in the case had gone cold, but if you told them you were going to eat it then, they fired it up hot for you. I got two chicken empanadas and a potato one for Rye. He thought they filled you up more. The man behind the counter was too tall for his job. He threw the goods in the toaster and turned the knob, then went back to his magazine. Drew still work here? I asked. He looked up. Who? We stared at each other for a moment. Forget it, I said, but he was back in the pages. I thought about getting a strawberry soda. My tongue felt thick. Put the potato one in a separate bag, I said. He separated them from me. Rye didn't want his. He looked at the bag a long time before saying no. Come on, we're lit, you're starving. I said, I'm not hungry. I don't even fuck with the potato ones, I said. He stopped. I'm not fucking hungry. Stop acting shady, I said. Shady? What, we in middle school? Strange, weird, suspect, indignant. What do you want me to say? Say my name, he belted out into the night. I was about to clown him for singing, but started eating instead. The chicken ones were too good and I was too hungry to wait for his bullshit to cease. They were hot all the way through. I missed cutting class to come grab a bag full of rye, talking about which coaches were after him. The day he got a letter from Moorhead State, his mom broke down and started thanking God, even though she wasn't religious like that. He was going to school for free. I bought bottles and we found a nice spot on the river, mixed Hypnotic with Henny, and drank until we couldn't feel Summer's absence. You know he would have laid you out, right? He said. What? Dub. He would have beat your ass. I put my empanada back in the bag and stared at him. Fuck him. Nah. He would have fucked you up. Rye cut me off. You got something you want to say? Why you mad? He said. Why'd you stop him then? He looked off. Because I didn't know you were going to knock Rolls out. I flexed my fist and thought about Rolls, bloody mouthed on the floor. I wish my car wasn't parked at Rye's. Maddie would be waiting. She hated when I came home lit, but she liked getting lit with me. I visited her so many weekends, we were trying to figure out how to move in together. Our time together was like repeated honeymoons, languid and blissful. Takeout, perfect sex before and after, falling asleep in ways that only we knew, having worked them out together night after night until we fitted like matryoshkas. He stopped smiling and watched the stoplight at the top of the hill change colors. The city was built on hills, with roads that curved and ended abruptly and led deeper and deeper into a labyrinth, split with a snaking river that changed color with the season because of the dye left over from the textiles back in the day. I did sleep with one white girl, he said. I crumpled the bag from the market and tossed it, wiped my mouth with the back of my hand. Why didn't you just say? He sped up a little and I lengthened my stride to follow. None of that shit would have happened, I said. Fuck you, you should have just fought him forever ago. He roasted you just as much, I said. He eased up on the pace. I'm just playing, I ain't sleeping no white bitch. What the fuck is wrong with you? I said. What happened? Nothing. Bro, remember when I caught you looking through my aunt's underwear? He shot me a look, then smiled. What had happened? What, man, shut up. The wind picked up to bring winter faster. Whatever it is, can't be that bad. Aight, he said. He glanced over at me. Well, in the middle of it, he started. We were at the stoplight. There were no cars. He started to cross. I followed. When I was hitting, yeah, I tried to catch up. She called me a nigger. I fell behind a step, then two. That's fucked up. It was all I could say. I thought about if Maddie pulled some shit like that. I thought about the type of white women that went out in search of that. The ones who kept the word in the back of their throats, an ugly secret, black appetite. Maddie wasn't like that. Guilt, maybe. That was his country. But nothing dank and malignant. I wasn't on an auction block in front of her. I thought back to when we'd look at each other in the mirror together, floor length at her parents in Manhattan, her hand around my dick, smiling. I tried for a minute to see what she saw. I told myself I wasn't on an auction block in front of her. Rye, I said. He woke up. And I reached the left onto his street before he did. Still, he was silent, trying to lock something inside, back where it belonged. I saw him grow fidgety, even in the shadow of the streetlight. Yo, I said. He turned. I liked it, he said. Liked what? When she said it, he paused. I fucking liked it. How? It made me harder. We neared his steps. Like, hardened your resolve to find a strong black woman? I raised my fist. He left the joke in space. I stopped as we reached the stairs. You're not staying? He said. Nah, man. He towed a spot where the stair was chipped and splintered. You know better, he said. I handed him his empanada. I just want to see Maddie, I said. He put his hand on the rail before he turned to go up and stopped. I loved it, he said. It made me an animal. Yeah. No, you don't understand, man. I grabbed her hair and turned her face away. I don't know. He took a breath. I wouldn't even let her look at me. She said it again. Fuck me like a nigger. He stared at the ground for a while. I wanted her so bad, he said. She tried to turn her face toward me and I just buried it deeper. I thought I was gonna break her. It's like I couldn't stop. I shoved my fingers down her throat with the other hand and she closed her eyes. I wouldn't even let her do that. I raised her eyelids so she had to keep one eye open. I bit her jaw and so I saw teeth marks. He brushed his hand over his waves like he'd always done. I lost my mind. He went up the first step. The automatic porch light came on. I imagined him walking up the stairs to the second floor in the pitch black, going home to no one, eating his food alone. Then it worked, I said. What? I took a few steps back. She got what she wanted. He held the paper bag tighter. His eyes softened. Say hi to Maddie for me. As I turned the corner, I heard the apartment door close.
How does a playwright observe this extraordinary drama called life?
I, like many people, grew up in a house that was loving and complicated. And so, you know, bitch is to me the language of friendship. And, you know, we all have to be our own friend at some point.
Bitch! I really dislike funny poems, or poems that are trying to be funny. They make me really mad because I think poems are already like, you know, they're songs and prayers. That's what they seem most like to me. And I don't like limericks.
This is an interview with Tennessee Williams. And the first question I'm going to pose to you, Mr. Williams, is the following. Why do you write?
That is an excellent question. I know that I couldn't face a day without writing, and the day would seem so completely empty to me that by the time the evening came, I would feel like shooting myself.
When did you see your first play, Mr. Williams? And do you recall what it was?
Yes, indeed I do. In St. Louis, where I lived, there was only one theater called the American Theater, way, way downtown toward the river, and there would be road shows coming in. And I only made $65 a month, and so I couldn't afford an orchestra seat or even a first balcony seat. I had to sit up in what they call the Peanut Gallery. Yes. Which is way, way, way up there. I saw about three plays before I decided to write plays. I saw The Barretts of Wimpole Street with Catherine Cornell, which I liked. I wasn't terribly thrilled by it, but I liked it. And one of them I can't remember. But the third I will never forget. That was Ibsen's Ghost with Nazimova.
Ah, fabulous.
And it was so fabulous, so terrifyingly exciting, that I couldn't stay in my seat. I suddenly jumped up and rushed out and began pacing the corridor of the Peanut Gallery and trying to hear what was being said on the stage at the same time, but I couldn't stand to watch it anymore. And I think I decided that night that I would write for the theater. Then I began to write plays.
Was it exceedingly difficult for you to gain recognition? The earlier phases of your life, I think, have been written about, and there was much tribulation, it seems to me, in getting your plays put on.
Yes, there was tremendous trouble about that, and maybe a lot of it is understandable. I've always had a tendency to go overboard, I think, to write too violently. This morning, I said to my doctor, I told him a dream. And he said, yes, well, we know you have a lot of violence in you, but we can't take that up right now.
I think that now we must come to the famous Paris Review question, which is, what are your writing habits? The Paris Review reader wants to know, what is your modus operandi, your ritual?
I'm glad you said ritual, because it is a ritual. For me, it's a ritual to prepare myself for writing in the morning. I write, as soon as I get up in the morning, there is this terrible question, will I be able to write today, and how will I write? And I begin with 2 cups of coffee, rather strong coffee, and then I go to my table and work. Some days, of course, the work doesn't go at all well. Other days, it does go well.
Yes. Mr. Williams, can you write anywhere?
I have to write anywhere I am. Because, as I said, unless I begin a day with writing, the day is utterly vacuous for me. You know, I feel it's a lost day.
Admonitions to a Special Person. A poem by Anne Sexton. Watch out for power, for its avalanche can bury you. Snow, 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 smothering your mountain. Watch out for hate. It can open its mouth and you'll fling yourself out to eat off your leg, an instant leper. Watch out for friends, because when you betray them, as you will, they will bury their heads in the toilet and flush themselves away. Watch out for intellect, because it knows so much it knows nothing, and leaves you hanging upside down, mouthing knowledge as your heart falls out of your mouth. Watch out for games, the actor's part, the speech planned, known, given, for it will give you away, and you will stand like a naked little boy pissing on your own child bed. Watch out for love, unless it is true, and every part of you says yes, including the toes. It will wrap you up like a mummy, and your scream won't be heard, and none of your running will run. Love, be it man, be it woman, it must be a wave you want to glide in on. Give your body to it, give your laugh to it. Give, when the gravelly sand takes you, your tears to the land. To love another is something like prayer and can't be planned. You just fall into its arms because your belief undoes your disbelief. Special person, if I were you, I'd pay no attention to admonitions from me, made somewhat out of your words and someone out of mine, a collaboration. I do not believe a word I have said, except some. Except I think of you like a young tree with pasted on leaves, and know you'll root and the real green thing will come. Let go. Let go. Oh, special person, possible leaves. This typewriter likes you on the way to them, but wants to break crystal glasses in celebration for you. When the dark crust is thrown off and you float all around like a happened balloon.
Films, The Paris Review Podcast, Episode 16, Lift and Fall. The pieces that you heard in this episode are Laguna Blues, a poem by Charles Wright. It appeared in The Paris Review, Issue 79, Spring 1981. It was read by
Bill Callahan
and scored by Emily Wells. What's Wrong with You? What's Wrong with Me? A short story written and read for us by the author,
J.M. Holmes.
It appeared in Issue 221, Summer 2017. Admonitions to a Special Person, a poem by Anne Sexton. It appeared in Issue 79, Spring 1981. It was read by
Jenny Slate.
You also heard excerpts from our Art of Theater interview with Tennessee Williams from Issue 81, Fall of 1981. A very special thanks to the Morgan Library and Museum, home of the archive of the Paris Review, which includes the Tennessee Williams recordings. This podcast is a co-production of the Paris Review and Stitcher. Our production team includes
John Delore,
Brendan Francis Newnham of Public Address Media,
Helena de Groot,
Craig Morgan Teicher,
Lori Dorr,
and me, Emily Nemens. Our advisory board members are Ijeoma Azoto, Alexander Chi, Glory Edom, Haley Gates, and Tony Ann Fernandez. We had production assistance from Ashley Warren. Special thanks to Daisy Rosario and Chris Bannon, the Chief Content Officer at Stitcher, and everyone over at TPR HQ. This episode was mixed and sound designed by Helena de Groot, featuring original music composed and performed by a talented ensemble that includes David Sieri, Emily Wells, Mike Brown, Sam Ospavat, Rob Schwimmer, Shazad Ismaili, and Casey Holford. Our theme song is composed by David Sieri. A very special thanks to Hendrix Gin, the presenting sponsor of Season 2 of the Paris Review podcast. Oddly infused with rose and cucumber, Hendrix Gin. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast, and while you're at it, please leave us a review. And if you want to read any of the pieces in this episode, subscribe at theparisreview.org. You'll get access to our 66-year digital archive, new essays on the Paris Review Daily, and the very best in new poetry, fiction, art, and interviews. A beautiful journal delivered straight to your door 4 times a year. Thanks for listening.
So Emily Dickinson will sue anything that breathes, you know?
So. Yeah. Super litigious. That's what they say. Is that the word litigious? No. What is it? Yeah.
No, yeah. That's it. Yeah.
That's it, right.
Emily Dickinson is litigious.
Litigious.
Stitcher.